Welcome to the Joy Factory, where we explore the art of happiness at work. I'm Susan DeFazio, your host and founder of Be Future Ready Today, where we develop toolkits that simplify our world of work and empower the how for healthier and happier outcomes so that people and businesses can truly thrive. Our podcast guests will come from all walks of life, and today we're delighted to welcome Zara Sanjua. So welcome, Zara. I first met Zara last year when we were both keynote speakers at the HR Network Awards conference, and I was fascinated by Zara's life experiences and stories. Zara is a Woman of the Future finalist, award-winning TV, radio, and podcast presenter, columnist, journalist, host, comedian, writer, producer, director, filmmaker, and charity trustee, to which my first reaction is just simply, wow. and the second one is, how do you ever manage to squeeze some sleep in, Zara?
Oh my gosh, I prioritize sleep above everything, to be perfectly honest. I honestly love sleep more than anything in the world, so I always make sure I get a solid 8 hours.
It's very important. Well done, you. I don't know how you do it, because I know you're very busy, and we're really lucky to have you considering all your commitments. But having read your article, Humor Me, It's Time to Get Serious at Work, and also knowing that you featured humor at Baroness Karen Brady's recent Women in Business and Tech Expo, I thought you'd just be ideal for this particular episode, which is about bringing humor to work. So We're looking forward to hearing your thoughts and stories about why humor at work is important, learning some valuable lessons from missteps or any missteps, and positively connecting with others. But first, I'd like to start our conversation, Zara, if you don't mind, by asking you more on a personal level, what does joy mean to you?
Oh, I mean, it's all about being completely in the moment, isn't it? You know that you're having a really joyful moment when you feel really present and still have this spark of passion, or, you know, it ignites some sort of creativity or ideas, really where you feel a connection. I always feel very fulfilled when I'm feeling joyful, and it usually is linked to, you know, leading a life of purpose. And that has so many different facets to it, because, you know, when I love being with my family. I have, I'm very close to my niece and my mum especially. And, you know, when I'm around them, it's always a joyful experience, because I feel so completely accepted. I feel myself. I feel in a place where, you know, that headspace just welcomes new ideas and builds that connection. And, you know, it really leads into my purpose, which is really about connecting with people and hearing stories.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. You know, the more and more I talk about this, it's we tend to think, I don't know if it's just as you mature, but sometimes you think about joy as massive events, you know, when I win the lottery or when I go and do this or that. But actually, it's often the simplest things and connecting with others that really spark that, I don't know, a deep sense of contentment and, as you said, creativity.
Well, they do say that it's a journey, don't they? It's not a destination. And I often remind myself of this when, you know, I'm in situations where, let's say, I'm stuck in a queue of traffic and late for an event or late for doing something. And you can very quickly become emotionally involved or emotionally engaged in things that just do not deserve your energy. So having to kind of constantly remind yourself that, you know, it's just as important to find value in those moments as it is to find value in the moments where you win the lottery, which, by the way, would be amazing.
Of course. We're not saying no, are we? But it's just sort of that sometimes the simplest things. But as a woman who has, you know, you do so many different things, and I've listened to some of your stories before about work and humor at work, I'm really fascinated to start off by and hear some of your stories, perhaps early days of humor when you were humor in the workplace. Tell us a bit about those, Zara. I think they would be really interesting for listeners.
or lack of humor in the workplace, I think, is more the problem. I do think that workplaces are generally quite dull. You know, there's sun fucking over, I'll say that. Fun fucking, that was the worst time to have spoonerism ever.
it is, but it's okay. It's okay.
I think workplaces are fun sucking vacuums. There we go. And they're just really not built to be enjoyable or to bring out creativity or inspiration, I don't think. And I had a lot of problems with humour when I was much younger. And I think when I was especially developing in the corporate world, I discovered that I was I felt like a corporate clown, if I'm being honest, quite a lot, because my sense of humour, I'm very self-deprecating most of the time. I don't have a style of humour that would attack others or make light of, you know, minorities, or, you know, I'm just not the kind of person that goes after people. I'm not one of them. I would quite often make fun of myself, which is, you know, it's part of being self-deprecating. So, for instance, you know, if my boss would say, can I get a team update? And I had not achieved my goals, instead of, you know, shying into the background and not saying anything, I'd quite happily step forward and say, well, you know, Jenna secured 4 clients, but I've just eaten a dog biscuit thinking it was chocolate. So, you know, and things like, you know, or if my boss once asked me, we were talking about failure in general, and she said that she was fascinated by it. And, you know, I would make comments like, you know, I'm happy to let you observe me for research if you like, which always undermines and undercuts my own value. I didn't realize that was what was happening at the time. I kind of, you know, I always thought that self-deprecating humor was a good thing and, you know, it was a positive thing. But actually, when you don't really have any status. So, and I hate to talk about it in such a yucky way in such hierarchical terms, but when you haven't really achieved a lot of success and you are just starting out, that self-deprecating humor, you know, I didn't think there was any victims, but I was making myself a victim. Mm-hmm. I was the victim of the jokes, and it was basically communicating to my peers and to my bosses that I was incompetent, I was incapable. And it took time to realize that, you know, as you get older, as you gain experience, and certainly as you climb the ladder, mm-hmm. self-deprecating humor is far more endearing and actually far more likely to win people over if you are the boss, if you're self-deprecating, than you know, if you're attacking others or you have different sort of humor self, sniper humor, sense of humor. And so I think that a lot of the issues I had really came down to not understanding how to harness the power that I had with my sense of humor, because I did have a sense of humor, who knew? And I mean, everyone does. If you've ever laughed at anything in your life, you have a sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it was, you know, it took years of cultivating that, whereby, you know, now it's responsible for, you know, 40%, directly 40% of my income. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of an intangible value that I get from having humor now ingrained in who I am and putting it forward when I meet people, and it's part of my own personal branding story. So yeah. You know, humor, learning that and being able to cultivate it and to channel it and use it appropriately, that's been really important.
And I guess you it sounds to me as if you sort of learned the hard way. So that I agree with you, self-deprecating humor. I tend to be a lot like that. But I think it is easier for people who are further up the power ladder, perhaps, to be that person. So what, you know, how long did it take you to sort of learn that? I mean, you know, it sounds quite painful.
How would you like to measure time? I would say 21 sackings.
It probably, oh my word.
That's my unit of time measurement. I've been sacked 21 times, and for a range of things, you know. And the honest truth really is that I wasn't very aligned with my sense of purpose, but I also did feel a little bit like, you know, people use the square peg round hole analogy. Yeah. I felt like a rhombicosida dodecahedron, which is a very complex geometric shape. Which, and also, I'm so glad I managed to say that in one go without stopping. But it was, I felt very, I never felt like I fitted in. Right. And I'm from a mixed race background. My father's Pakistani, my mother's Ginger. So it was a very confusing, I think, time for me growing up. I felt split between two worlds. I was raised Muslim, but very much in a Christian society and still trying to figure out who I was at the time. And I think that kind of led to, a lot of imposter syndrome and a lot of I don't fit in. And I think that's why I really enjoy having such variety in my career, because all jobs are human made concepts. We kind of create these little niches and these pockets, and we decipher roles and we kind of carve those out and identify people by them. But I never felt like I wanted to fit into anything. And I think, when you are younger, you want to be just like everyone else and you want to fit in. But then as you get older, you start to see the real value in being different and feeling different. And, I think that I've found my space now. And that's having this valuable life with many different roles.
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, it's one of the, I guess, joys of being young, but it's also one of the crosses to bear, isn't it? That you I think it takes time to figure yourself out. And, every individual sort of struggles in some way, sort of thinking, I want to be able to fit in. I want to be able to connect with others. And the thing about humor, and, what you were saying earlier about environments being sort of fun sucking. fun sucking, exactly. I find that to be more and more true, because I remember back in early in my career that we had an extraordinary amount of fun and we laughed a lot, but it feels like now almost people are scared to bring humor into the workplace in case they overstep or misstep or...
Oh my gosh, yeah. Well, because it's also just so hard to negotiate anyway. But before we became, I think, more emotionally tapped into the power of our words. And actually, we have discussions all the time. At the moment, I'm working on a topical comedy show, a sketch show. Mm-hmm. The BBC, and we're having lots of really interesting conversations about how do you satirize race now? How do you satirize characters who are of a certain race without being racist? And it's really interesting, because actually we do understand that some of those harmful stereotypes that we've been perpetuating, it kind of goes a really long way to causing damage. And it hasn't been addressed until now. And I don't want to be responsible for that, So what are the harmful stereotypes, and are we tapping into that? And then how else can we satirize a person who, is Pakistani by, and give them a voice where, it's a radio show. So how can we give them that lovely kind of rich identity and context just with their voice, but without overplaying their accent?
Yes.
It's a great way to be. Okay. I think that I'm a very sensitive person. I'm very sensitive to other people's feelings, especially. And it would, nothing would make me more upset than realizing that I had made a joke at someone else's expense, or that I'd caused any harm or any offense in something I had said. I really dislike that. So this is great. It's a huge education for all of us. But what it does, because we're in this new era where we're being more tapped into the emotions of other people and the impact of our words, people are scared that they're going to overstep the mark. And listen, people do it all the time. There was a really great case study of this businesswoman who she would take commercial flights and fly all over the world. And I think she'd taken a number of, I think she was setting off in England, and she said she was live tweeting her entire journey. Mm-hmm. And she mentioned something about, bad teeth and tea, it must be, I'm in London. And she was kind of making all these comments in places, and they were a bit distasteful and not particularly funny, but she was doing this live tweet for her entire journey. Only when she was heading to Africa, the final leg of her journey, she tweeted something so abhorrent. I can't even say it. It was so awful. Right. But she said that she's going to Africa and she better not get AIDS. and then said, lol, I'm white. Only joking, I'm not going to get AIDS, or something to that effect. And by the time she landed, she had no idea that her tweet had gone viral. She'd no idea that she had caused offence to hundreds of thousands of people around the world. And when she landed, she'd lost her job. And, you know, this is the real impact. But I mean, those kind of cases are really, it's really easy to see because there's no light or shade. You know, we're in workplaces, you know, you do have to be really mindful of how your words are impacting others and how your sense of humor is impacting others. But it's actually really easy to do if you have emotional intelligence.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think understanding basically when things go wrong and knowing how to navigate that side of things can be really helpful, because you're allowed to make mistakes no matter what cancel culture would have us believe. It's okay, you're allowed to mess up, it's perfectly normal. All comedians do it. We all have days that we're completely bomb, and you know, there's ways of dealing with that. And you know, when you deal with your first heckler, you deal with the first time that jokes don't land, you learn to adapt, you learn to apologize, you learn to move on. And actually being able to identify really quickly, I think there's a lot in reading the room, you know, you'll know when something hasn't gone down well that you've said it. So being able to act on that really quickly and address it, and also knowing why it hasn't gone well, has someone, one person in particular, been targeted? Have a whole group of people been targeted? Was it just in bad taste? Well, say it. Do you know what? I'm really sorry. That was really inappropriate. Or I can see that that's caused some offence. I'm not ready for live Apollo yet, clearly. So apologies, please. Let's go on.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. It's far better, I think, to bring humour into the workplace in a way that you feel that you can genuinely connect with others and not belittle others. But, you know, we all do make mistakes. And I think what you're saying is, when you recognise it, that reading the room is really important, of course. But when you recognise it, say, oh my gosh, that just, I am so sorry. It's not what I intended to do. Please help me get better. That type of thing. But I tell you, one of the things that really, when you and I spoke previously, we were talking about doing this episode, and I wasn't aware of it, but I was really fascinated about this whole thing about boundaries at work and respectful boundaries. And you led me to a couple of professors at Stanford, and they're teaching humor. And you also talked about a humor quiz, and I went back and looked at that, and that was absolutely fascinating, because you know, you've got the, I think you'll know it way better than me, but there's a couple of them in there which are, that really resonated. One was snipers, and I thought, oh, even before I knew the definition of a sniper, I thought, I've worked with several of those snipers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you often, you know, because you feel like you've been a victim.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You know, somebody's made fun at your expense. And you know, the other thing, the guidance here is, if you're senior, even if it's just by experience, not necessarily by hierarchy, is that you never direct humor at somebody who is of lower rank or status, because it just is incredibly harmful to them. And I just thought more people should look at that humor quiz, Zara, and just help them understand themselves, perhaps, you know?
You know, the professors you mentioned, it's Dr. Jennifer Aker and Naomi Bagdonis, and they are, yes, at Stanford University, teaching the world's future business leaders at Stanford University how to use humor in work. And they wrote a book called Humor Seriously, which is fabulous. And they have a fantastic website. You can go and check it out. They also have this quiz, as you mentioned. And what the quiz does is it identifies four humor types. So it looks at, you know, do you have an expressive or a more subtle style of humor? You know, are you aggressive or are you affiliative? And within that range, they've identified the different types. And I would say that I fall between a magnet and a sweetheart. Right. So magnets are really positive, warm and uplifting. They usually would, you know, avoid controversial or really upsetting humour, and often are seen to radiate charisma, which is a really lovely place to be. Mm-hmm. Sweethearts are a bit more earnest and honest, and but there's sometimes their humour just, it flies under the radar, it goes unnoticed. Mm-hmm. Whereas on the other side of this, you have stand-ups and snipers. And stand-ups, they are natural entertainers. They are not afraid to ruffle feathers for laughs. And then snipers that you mentioned are really edgy, really sarcastic, but sometimes nuanced, and they are completely unafraid to cross the line. Mm-hmm. So if you are a stand-up or a sniper, if you recognize that that's your own humor self, first of all, I mean, this is where you start on your journey for using humor at work, is identify your own. Who yeah. are you, and where do you fall into this? And what are the pitfalls? What are the things to watch out for? And how can you actually use this superpower? Because it is a superpower. You know, people who have a sense of humor at work, they incorporate into groups more easily. The studies show that they can go on to earn more money. They're more creative. They're healthier, they're happier. There's yeah. so many benefits to it. But if you're a stand-up or a sniper, you might run the risk quite often of offending people, because it's just riskier. So everything that you've just mentioned, you know, being aware of your status and how you're using, are you using your superpower for good or for evil? You know, are you using it to help promote other people? You know, it's perfectly okay in your group setting to make other companies the butt of your joke, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of making it about people, think of, you know, the jokes that you have where you could target, you know, faceless entities rather than individuals. Whereas, yeah, I think with magnets and sweethearts, often because their humour is kind of so low-key and often self-deprecating, the other risk of using that, of course, is that you end up making yourself look a little bit silly and you yeah. don't have to take status. So, yeah, I mean, there's being aware of it, that humour type quiz, I would recommend anyone to have a look at. It's really fun. It's really free to do. It's free to do online, so you can go and check it out at any time. And, you know, I think we're only just discovering this whole area, though. We're only really getting into the research of humour in the workplace.
But I think it's so important. I mean, you know, when I was sort of looking at research around this, and without getting too academic, something kind of really jumped out at me, because it goes back several years, because it goes back to Dwight Eisenhower, and he said a sense of humor is part of the art of leadership, of getting along with people and of getting things done. And I thought, I think it should become absolutely, if you like, mandatory, I don't like that word, but absolutely part of, even if you're not leading a group, but as a team player, learning how to make those connections and being able to trust in others that if you do make a misstep, you're going to be supported through that misstep. I just think there needs to be a more of a light, if you like, shone on humor at work and how we can successfully connect it to getting stuff done in a really great way.
Well, I work in a lot in ED&I in that space, and mm-hmm. quite often we talk about the business argument behind it. There are huge business arguments behind using humor at work, even as an individual. So, you know, you quite literally are laughing all the way to the bank, because yeah. they've identified this beige ceiling. So the difference between those employees who are seen to have a sense of humour and those who don't. And, you know, there's a huge difference in what our salary potential can be, what our career progression can look like. There's an argument there for, as an individual, to start thinking about, how am I presenting myself to the world, to work? How am I showing up? How am I interacting with people, engaging with them? Am I being memorable? You know, mm-hmm. and actually, I work for myself, and mm-hmm. most of my clients, I mean, I'm so grateful for them, because every week I get such exciting opportunities, great challenging projects to work on. But the only reason I'm in those people's minds is because I have built a connection with them. You know, that along the way I've said something or done something memorable. And sometimes it's as simple as knowing that the benefits of humor are emotional. It yes. make people feel something. That's like a mental post-it note. They will remember you. And, you know, part of humor is not just being, you're not expected to be a stand-up comedian. No one's expecting you to be Amy Schumer. It's also enjoying other people's sense of humor, because that's the key thing is, you know, if you laugh at someone else's joke, it's kind of like endorsement, you know,
endorsing it
and showing that you have your own sense of humor. So even if you are not the funny one or want to be, just start thinking about how you express your appreciation for other people's moments of levity in the workplace. And actually, levity is the key word, isn't it? Because really, we're aiming to create a bit of lightness. Workplaces spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds every single year trying to build teams and taking people away for the weekends and having all these initiatives in the workplace. And actually, you know, if they were all just encouraged to be themselves a bit more and relax and have fun and bring levity, and, you know, it would just be a lot more enjoyable, and they wouldn't need to spend as much money either.
Well, exactly, because, you know, I mean, it's easy to... When you delve into the subject of humor at work and you look at some of the research and have these kind of conversations, are actually, it just puts you in touch with the moments that you remember that you were memorable or somebody else was memorable in your life and so on. But one of the things that really strikes me about you is that, you know, when you did the keynote, you were the range of, I guess, the memorable range that you left me with was that you were self-deprecating. You were able to tell stories of funny stories about yourself, but also you could really switch to doing serious things. And I know that you combine, you know, you've got a huge range sort of in terms of talent, but, you know, you do comedy, but you also do really serious stuff, you know, out in Nepal with women that have been disadvantaged. And I, you know, it's interesting to hear you say that those are the humor helps connect you to some of the things where you really are passionate about, and you can use humor to shine a light on people that are perhaps don't often get, you know, they don't bubble up to the top. They need their stories to be told.
Well, you know, I'll give you an example. I mean, I decided when I went full-time self-employed to dedicate every year, you know, a few weeks to doing a project, usually a documentary, that I would then be able to give as a piece of content to an organization so they could use for fundraising. And the first year I decided to do this, I went out to Nepal to film with a group of marginalized and disabled women, and we were doing a sustainability tour that had been set up to support the work being done by the organization. And, you know, it's obviously, you know, these women's lives have been devastated by their illness and or by their disability, and the social structures don't really exist out in Nepal where there's no financial support there. But often as well, there's culturally a sense that if you have a disability that you might have done something in a former life, so there wasn't the same sympathy structure there for them either. It was a really, you know, a lot of these women ended up being in very abusive relationships. There was very little education for them, and I really connected with that and thought, it really is by accident that I was born in the UK. You know, I could have quite easily been born into any of these people's situations. And, you know, I do feel compelled to use the filmmaking skills I have, because it aligns with my purpose. It makes me feel that, you know, that I'm leading a life of purpose. So very serious work, very important work. But, you know, when we went out one day, we went on a tour to Monkey Temple. And Monkey Temple is this amazing place up in the hills, and you climb, you know, 364 steps and you get to the top, and the noisy city below is just so distant. You can hear bells chiming in the distance, dogs barking and traffic below. But up in the temple, there were Buddhist monks chanting and bells ringing, and it was so serene and so peaceful. And I got pissed on by a monkey, just to clarify.
No way. really weird. Why do I laugh at that? Sorry, Zara.
But at the time, honestly, it was awful, and it was, you know, hot weather, and so, like, he was like running down, and I swear he laughed at me, the wee arsehole. He did. I looked up and he laughed at me and he stuffed it off. And this woman, Nepalese woman, was standing. She gave me a cloth to help clean up some of the mess. And she said to me, "Very lucky." And I thought, I'm not sure I believe that. And then, of course, we a month after coming back, we went into lockdown, and you know, the whole world was going through a pandemic. So I was a bit I was cynical, to say the least. But you know, that moment, it could have been really embarrassing, and it could be the kind of thing that when it happens, you choose not to share it and you choose not to kind of tell people, or you feel really embarrassed by it.
Yes.
I thought it was hilarious. And I didn't mind talking about it with people, and I didn't mind sharing that, because it was a real, you know, it's just a moment of levity.
Of course.
And these kind of difficult times. And so, but what's interesting is that that moment, I then sort of later on, after being in lockdown for a year, and I changed, you know, I ended up growing different business arms and legs and doing other things, and having lots of lovely successes and awards, and that was great. And I thought, I want to trace back the origins of this success, and I did for a while think it was the monkey pee.
Really? Well, see, there you go. Wow.
For a while, I was in a bit of a woo-woo vibe for a while, and I was thinking, gosh, was it the majestic golden shower I received at that temple?
There could very well be something in that. But you know,
honestly,
I think,
people, if you want to do well in life, get yourself along to Monkey Temple, hang about for a bit, just hang about where they usually they poke their bums over the edges. Just that's the safe place. That's where you go.
Well, you know, I think there's something to be said in this life for sort of making your own luck. But I think we can all do with a little bit of help now and again. But I do believe, and I feel that we should be on a mission to bring more humor into the business world. Because you know, times are pretty dire at the moment. Everywhere you look, there's bad news and so on. So yeah, there's lots of great research out there. But I read something that said, I think it was from Gallup, that said that actually people laugh significantly more on the weekends than they do on weekdays. And I think, Zara, we should be on a mission to absolutely change that and make it, you know, 7 days a week and not just 2 days a week.
Well, this is why people are living for the weekends, though, isn't it? And actually why so many people report having the Sunday blues. You know, I used to get them when I was in school, and that feeling of dread and just, oh God, I have to go in tomorrow, and starting to kind of invent illnesses in your head and think, you know, maybe do I have a bit of a cough? Do I have a bit of a sore stomach? Is there any reason I don't want to go in tomorrow? Yeah, any excuse just not to bother going in. And, you know, Gallup are great because they've been doing a lot of research into humour in the workplace and humour in our lives, because they found that the average 4-year-old laughs 300 times a day. But by the age of 40, it takes us 4.5 months to reach that on the laughometer. So,
oh my goodness, that's quite...
I think
we should absolutely be on this mission to change that. And certainly, you know, when we were preparing and just chatting about this concept for this episode, you directed me to the Stanford stuff, and it really has helped me. And I think for anybody listening and listening to your stories, but also pointing them in the direction of where they can sort of read a bit more, discover a bit more about themselves. Because at the end of the day, you know, I think at work, it's, yes, you can have a purpose, but the people around you create the stickiness. Mm-hmm. And to do that, my belief is you have to connect, and in connecting, it can't all just be about making money, reaching targets, making an impact in society. All of these things are really good, but you have to have, dare I say it, fun along the way, or else, you know, it's just depressing not to have fun along the way.
But that is really how you tap into the potential for your workplace culture, isn't it? That's where the sweet spot is. If people feel they can be themselves. And I think there's a nurturing that comes with this where, you know, when you start out and you go for your very first job interview and someone, usually a parent, would say to you, just be yourself. Relax, enjoy it. And that is the hardest thing in the world to do. And it's almost like we spend our lives trying to figure out who we are and unpick all this kind of the years that we've had of programming to be some sort of corporate bot or robot. business bot, as I like to call them. So that kind of, there's a lot you know, I think that the 20, 30 years ago even, you know, we were living in a very different time, and there was a version of yourself that you were, that you had to present at work. And actually some people still wear it like an armor. Yeah. But we're living in a time, a more authentic time. People want to see the real human. They want to connect with people. And actually, you know, the value in that is incredible. The value in actually understanding, you know, people talk about it a lot. You buy, you don't buy from businesses, you buy from people. But that's the, and that's the business argument to it. But it's so much more intangible than that, really. It's the benefits for that I have seen in myself from being able to fully embrace, and I'm still on a sort of journey of learning who I am and my own sense of humor and becoming better at what I do and wanting to aim higher. And I mean, I'm still on the road, but I've seen that not only has it changed my relationships with people, it's changed how much I like myself. It's changed the way I correspond with people. And actually the correspondence is a really interesting one to look at, because ultimately, if you want to start using humor in your workplace, you have to start with how you communicate.
Yes.
And there was a Deloitte actually did this. They introduced a great system called the Bullfighter, where they discovered there was a lot of jargon that had been coming into, you know, internal and external communications, and they just decided that enough was enough. They wanted to try and do a massive turnaround internally, and so I think it was in 2017 they created this bit of software to get rid of the jargon and to help people communicate more authentically and more like humans. Yeah. And so this software was implemented where it would automatically flag anything that was written in emails or in documents that was jargony or that was really stiff. And so they decided to, you know, roll this out. It was a great PR exercise as well, because they did really well in with their corporate comms. But it was a great way of sort of having a bit of fun as well. I mean, even the name of the Bullfighter, it was, you know, based on them fighting bullshit, which...
Yes.
Go on. And so what they took away from that really was, you know, look at the communications, look at your emails, look at even things like your out of office and your email signature. How are you having a bit of fun? Is there any sign of life out there when you write something? And even your sort of classic intros, if you think about it, when I was starting to learn how to write even cover letters and things, it was always dear sir and madam. Yes. And what an awful way, especially now we have the internet, now you can just search online and find details about people and say, you know, speak to them directly, use their first and second names. We can also open really strong, because we can say, I have just seen that you've won this award. That was amazing. You were up against this, you know, that, you know, or just be personal, make some sort of impact. And also the one thing I really benefited from is what I like to call magic beans.
Oh, okay. Go on.
So magic beans are you leaving any sort of, it's almost like a trail of breadcrumbs, but I like to call them magic beans, because magic beans grow beanstalks. And that's the way I see this, is if you are talking to someone for the first time, if you're sending an email, we tend to be really formal. Lovely to meet you. This is why I'm getting in touch. Here's my details. I'd love to know what you think. Thanks very much. Best wishes. That is... There's nothing in that would make anybody connect with you.
Yes.
So you really have to find some happy balance between, you know, you don't want to write War and Peace or tell them your entire autobiography, but you do want to post something in there that tells them a little bit about you. And, you know, for example, if I was, I'm staying up in Petulie in Fraserburgh just now, and I might just put something like, oh, I'm up in Fraserburgh at the moment. Thankfully, you know, the Wi-Fi is working, looking out at the sea just now. Hope you're well, looking forward to the Christmas holidays. Are you planning a little escape anywhere? And then just then get into it, because it's such a great way to just leave them the magic bean that they can water. And if they want to water it, they will come back and say, I've just Googled it. What a beautiful place. How long are you staying there for? I've always loved the Northeast, or I've never been to the Northeast. I'm actually planning to go away and see my family. And there you go. The door is open. You're able to go and, you know, find the magic goose, the golden goose. So which is that connection that you want to build.
Well, you know, Zara, I think you are masterful at this, because, you know, having just listened to the keynote that you did last year, you certainly did that sort of breadcrumbing with your magic beans, because it made me curious to know more about you. And I'm so glad. You've been able to share on this episode so many valuable insights. I hope the listeners take as much of it as away from the episode as I do. But for me, there's so many great takeaways. I'll do some show notes and so on. But I do know that you've written a book and you're about to write a new book. But tell the listeners how they can get in touch with you if they want to find out more about, you know, what you do and how you can sprinkle humour into their lives.
Oh, well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to shamelessly plug. I've just written my book, which is 21 Ways to Get Thacked. So I'll be able to tell them more about that. It's, of course, unashamedly fetishizing my own failures in life and sort of what I learned along the way. But the Trojan horse really is that it's how to have a multi-hyphenate career. How do you start one? How do you build one? How do you maintain one? And it's all told through lots of anecdotes, lots of stories of times where things went catastrophically wrong in my career. And they obviously did many times, 21 in fact. So yes, that's what the book is. But if you want to, I mean, I have a website, it's zarajandua.com. And I mean, I'm all over the place. I'm just constantly on especially Instagram and Twitter at TV Zara J. I honestly love a bit of social media, so I'm all over that. If you want to come and say hello, then I would love
following you, Zara. It's just, it really, you do, even although I'm not, you know, when I'm not speaking to you, I think, oh gosh, here's a post. I must look at it and see where you are, and whether it's Egypt or up a mountain or wherever it is, it's great. And I really want to thank you for taking part. And let's make this our mission to get more humour into the workplace. What do you think?
Oh, Susan, I'm up for it. And I'm going to get you to do some stand-up at some point.
Oh, my goodness, that would terrify me. You can coach me. You can coach me.
We'd love to. We'd love to.
All right. Well, listen, Zara, thank you very, very much. Wow, what a refreshing conversation to have with Zara Zanjua. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did hosting this particular episode of Bringing Humour to Work. I think we can take many takeaways from this particular episode. Please join us on the next episode, where I'll be chatting to our next guest and discovering their thoughts about how we connect and create happiness for ourselves and others.